Turn it on, wait. Good afternoon. We're going to call this meeting of the State Department Veterans Budget Division to order. It's Thursday, April 4th, 2013, approximately 3:15, and a quorum is present. Members, today we're going to finish hearing bills to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. We do have a full agenda. We'll continue tonight until we've come through the, through the night, but it isn't going to be through the night. Senator Chamberlain has assured me of that, so I'm not even going to worry about it. But we do have a full agenda. I'm going to start with Senator Skoy, who's going to be presenting Senate File 1124 for Senator Reinhart today. Senator Skoy, thank you for doing that. And
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be here standing in for Senator Reinhart, who had to be away from the Capitol today. I think he asked me if I would be willing to stand in for him on this real important and flattery for me to be due to present this bill that is dealing with the commissioning of the new ship, the USS Minnesota. And he asked me if I would be willing to stand in for him. He knows that my daughter is currently serving in the Navy. So I am pleased to be here with Mr. Hutton, and we are going to present some information to you about the new USS Minnesota and the needs for the state to be involved in the costs that revolve around the commissioning that is going to be occurring in the coming year. And so we have a request in front of this committee to help us pay for some of those costs, and I think you're going to be quite impressed with some of the history behind USS Minnesota's of the past and the new USS Minnesota attack submarine that we're going to be commissioning in the coming year. And so with that, Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Hutton, and he will fill in all the gaps and the details about what we're looking forward as a state and our new USS Minnesota ship.
Thank you, Senator. And Mr. Hutton, if you'd identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Dave Hutton. I am a retired naval officer myself. I am the president of the Navy League of the United States Twin Cities Council and the co-chair of the commissioning committee for USS Minnesota. Along with me today, I'd like to introduce, I have active duty Captain Dave Rattay, who is the commanding officer of the Navy ROTC unit here at the University of Minnesota. And alongside him is Chip Sherritt, retired U.S. Navy captain, who is one of our board members with the Navy League. I know your time is very valuable, so I'll make this very brief and answer any questions that you might have. Up on the screen, you see a depiction of a fast attack submarine. USS Minnesota is right now, it's called PCU Minnesota for pre-commissioning unit. It began construction in February of 2008. The keel was authenticated in May of 11, and she was pressure hull complete in May of last year. We attended her christening ceremony at Newport News. She's being built at Newport News Shipyard in Virginia, and she will be home ported most likely in Groton, Connecticut. The commissioning will take place September 7th of this year in Norfolk, Virginia, and if any of you are interested in attending, I can get you invitations.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Actually, that's my home, and I am very definitely interested in an invitation.
Yes,
ma'am. I would go if you get me an invitation.
Absolutely, ma'am. Not a problem.
Thank you.
What you see on here, we, about a year and a half ago, hosted a contest to design the ship's logo, which is essentially the brand of the ship. Every ship and squadron in the U.S. Navy has its own logo. And they came to us to try to help them design that. So we hosted a competition for high school and college students here in Minnesota. And the winning entrant was a homeschool high school student out of the Roseville area, Jacob Bartles. And he designed the logo that you'll see, did a wonderful job for it. FedEx Corporation brought forward a $1,500 scholarship that Mr. Bartles received as a result of winning it. And Swage Lock Corporation from here in Minnesota is going to host he and his family to attend the commissioning. This is the logo. There's a number of design elements in it that are really unique, but I don't have time right now to take you through all of that. But the crew absolutely loves this design, and it came right here out of Minnesota.
It is a nice logo.
The history of the USS Minnesota, this ship will be a Virginia-class fast attack submarine. She will be the third ship to bear the name USS Minnesota. The first USS Minnesota was actually named after the river. She was a wooden steam frigate fought in the Civil War in the Battle of Hampton Roads with the Monitor and the Merrimack. The second USS Minnesota was a battleship in Teddy Roosevelt's Great White Fleet. She circumnavigated the globe with that fleet. She was commissioned in 1905, decommissioned in 1921. So it's literally over 100 years since there's been a ship that was commissioned named USS Minnesota. This is the picture of the Battle of Hampton Roads, and you see the first USS Minnesota on the right. There's the second one, the battleship. That's her crew, quite sizable crew. This crew on this USS Minnesota will be about 135 personnel, about 120 enlisted and 15 officers. We have developed a very strong relationship with the crew already, and in the last 2 years, they've already paid 6 visits to the state here, where they do community outreach events. They help with some STEM education, some things like that. In the lower picture there, you see the captain of the Minnesota enlisting a number of prospective sailors, and that was right on the steps here at the Capitol Building last summer. When they were in town and they met Governor Dayton at that time. And in the upper picture, they're standing on the sideline at Target Field, and they got a chance to meet Gardy, and the captain got a chance to throw out the first pitch. Virginia-class submarine. It's pretty interesting the way that the Navy builds submarines these days. It's kind of like Legos. They build them in modular fashion where they build big chunks and then move the big chunks into place and put them together. It's really a fascinating process. Here you see a piece of the tail cone. Another tail section of the ship. Every ship that's commissioned has a sponsor by tradition. It's normally a lady. In this case, it's Mrs. Ellen Roughhead. She is a Minnesota native as a young child. She's the wife of the recently retired Chief of Naval Operations, Gary Roughhead, and a wonderful lady. John Fancher is the commanding officer of the USS Minnesota. He is married to an Edina native, Amy. And John's a really sharp guy. The keel authentication, as I mentioned, took place in May of 2011. What they do with that is, in lieu of what you used to see many years ago, a keel laying ceremony, what they do here is they actually take a piece of steel, and the ship sponsor etches her initials on that piece of steel, and they have a welder come and weld her initials onto that plate of steel, and then that plate of steel is physically attached to the ship for the life of the ship. Christening ceremony was, you can see the entire hull here. The name Minnesota is no longer on the ship. They take that off right afterwards. You'd be surprised how many people ask about that, though.
Yeah. I think I was going to ask about that.
Okay. Yeah, no, Navy submarines are completely black. They don't want to have identifying marks on the ship, as Captain Rattay, who was the former commanding officer of USS Minneapolis-St. Paul, would be able to tell you more about than I can. The christening, here you see a little bit of the inside of the ship, the control room, the torpedo room. The crew's mess is active pretty much 24/7. They're feeding the crew when they're underway. Daytime doesn't really have a whole lot of meaning. So why do we want to do this? We're asking the state to help us. We're forming a public and private partnership. To date, we have raised close to $200,000 on the private side. And we're asking the state to become involved with this, to have that partnership. We want to support the crew. We want to support the crew of the ship and show them that the state of Minnesota honors their service. One of the things that will happen, this ship will be in service for about 35 years, and every time they pull into a port anywhere around the world and they put the brow across to the pier, they're going to hang a banner on that brow that's going to say Minnesota. So we're going to get some nice public relations out of that for about 35 years. This was a moving ceremony. As I mentioned, the first USS Minnesota was in the Battle of Hampton Roads, and the USS Monitor defended her. After that battle, the Monitor was headed down to Charleston for a naval battle down there, but she ran into some really bad weather off of Cape Hatteras, and she sunk. 10 years ago, they raised the turret of the USS Monitor, and when they raised the turret, they found the remains of 2 of the 16 sailors that were lost at sea in that accident. 3 weeks ago, March 8th, they had a memorial and interment ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery, and some of the crew from the Minnesota came up to it to honor their relationship with the Monitor, and I had the honor of going to that ceremony as well. It was a full military honors burial. They had the remains in two caskets, and after the service in the chapel, they put them on the horse-drawn caissons and full 21-gun salute. It was quite an event. Our current fundraising efforts, as I mentioned, this shows where our current fundraising on the private side is, and we're making more progress there. We're continuing to raise funds. Our total goal is approximately $350,000 to $400,000. It will all be kept in a completely separate account, audited every year, and we are a 501c3. And any funds that we raise in excess of what we need to support the commissioning ceremony will go to two things. One, we have an intention to endow one or two college scholarships for crew members or family of the USS Minnesota. We understand that the state funds cannot be used for that, and so we'll make sure that we keep that separate. And anything above and beyond that we raise in the account will be kept to support future crew visits here to the state of Minnesota for sailors from the ship to come and do community outreach events, STEM education, things like that. And that pretty much concludes my presentation. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them, sir.
Questions for Mr. Hutton or Senator Skoy? If not, thank you for your presentation. Oh, Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For Minnesota being a Midwestern state, we're kind of fortunate to have a ship or a submarine named after our home state. I just wanted to mention that we had a submarine that was christened back in 1984. It was the USS Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Sir.
And happened to have the captain of that ship was from Thief River Falls, one of the captains, I should say. And, of course, that ship had gained some notoriety, or that submarine gained some notoriety during Desert Storm when they used the, I think it was one of the submarines that used Tomahawk missiles when the U.S. invaded Iraq.
Yes, sir. In fact, we have one of the former commanding officers of USS Minneapolis St. Paul with us today, and Captain Rete. He could probably tell you more about that. But thank you. A little bit of dirty laundry, I hate to say it, but when Minneapolis St. Paul was commissioned, which was, I believe, 1984, I'm sorry, the governor at that time and the mayors of both cities and our national congressional delegations were all invited to that commissioning ceremony. None of them showed. So the Secretary of the Navy at that time, John Lehman, made public note of that, and he said if it was up to him, there would never be another ship affiliated with Minnesota. So we're fortunate to be where we're at. And we have been promised by the governor that he'll be in attendance and a bunch of our congressional delegations. And as I said, any of you who would like to attend, we'll get you the invitations.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the lady that christened the Minneapolis and St. Paul was Mrs. Penny Dernberger at that time.
Yes, sir.
Any other comments, questions? If not, Senate File 1124 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We appreciate your consideration of this.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Skoy. Mr. Hutton. Next, we're going to do Senate File 1119, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. That's a pretty tough act to follow. And before I get started with
Senate... Well, I'm sure you'll do a good job.
I'll try. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and your staff. I've been a little under the weather on Tuesday. The bill was scheduled, but thank you for accommodating me and moving the bill to today.
You look a lot better today than you did.
You look a lot better. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 119 deals with the paid sick leave for service in the military. Current law provides public employees with 15 days of paid leave each year for military service. In addition, National Guard and service members are allowed unpaid leave for other time away from their job. This bill would allow these employees to determine when to use the 15 days of paid leave along with their unpaid leave. I was contacted by a police officer in Austin, Minnesota, after he was notified that he was required to use his paid military leave before any unpaid military leave. As a police officer, he works overnights and weekends and often has to use his military leave, paid or unpaid, for his once-a-month drills, weekend drills. Being forced to use all his paid leave for the drill weekends creates a financial hardship for his young family during the 2 weeks of service reservists and National Guard members must perform each year. This gentleman is servicing his community as a police officer and has for over 14 years and has over 14 years of military service. Allowing him and others like him the flexibility to determine when to best use the modest 15 days of paid leave in order to maintain the financial well-being of his young family seems like a reasonable step. I would thank you, Mr. Chair, and members for consideration. I would certainly appreciate your support of this important bill.
So, kind of in a couple of sentences, kind of fill us in on what we're doing here, will you?
But what happens, Mr. Chair and members, is in most instances, if a normal police officer or an EMT or a firefighter works a 9-to-5 job, it doesn't get to be such a hardship. But this gentleman doesn't have as much seniority as other members. So when he's required to do weekend drills, he has to take time off for either that night shift or the weekend that he's working. If he uses those 15 days up, by the time it's the 2 weeks that he heads up to Camp Ripley, in many instances, it puts a financial burden on him, and I think he has two young children.
Okay. All right. Do we have any questions from the committee on for Senator Sparks? If not, Senator Sparks, we're going to lay over Senate File 1119 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you for your
Thank you very much, Mr. Today. Chairman and members.
Senator Dibble here?
Yes.
Great. Senator Dibble, we have Senate File 1529.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Thank you. Senate File 1529 is Minnesota Public Radio's equipment grant appropriation bill. Mr. Chair, it seeks $310,000 in fiscal year 2014 and, again, the same in 2015 from the general fund. But just a few quick points about Minnesota Public Radio. A million people tune into NPR each week. Millions more unknowingly rely on NPR's statewide broadcasting signal for emergency and safety information. NPR is made up of 80 stations and translator stations, and their signal covers 95% of the population of our state. It's the only broadcaster that has a statewide broadcasting signal that does blanket the entire state. And, of course, as we all know, it provides access to regional Minnesota-specific news, up-to-date weather, other information, cultural programming, et cetera. It is the backbone for the emergency alert and AMBER child abduction alert signals. The governor has appropriated $620,000, the 310 and the 310, in his budget, and this bill is simply a reflection of that request. It's a Radzik from NPR who can share some more information if you so
desire. Ms. Radzik, welcome.
Chair Saxhog, members, senators, I've been before you to discuss at length.
Ms. Radzik, even though I recognize you, so you have to tell.
My name is... Mr. Chair, members of the committee, senators, my name is Lisa Radzak with Minnesota Public Radio.
Thank you.
I've been before you to discuss at length our appropriations, so in the interest of time, I'm here to answer any of your questions, follow-up questions, et cetera.
As you say, the presentation has been made on the basis that we've already seen. Questions from the committee? If not, what we're going to do then is lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and we appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Senator, Chair, and members.
Senator Pappas, she's on her way.
So really it's you?
It's me.
You can present for Senator Metzen.
Yeah. And yourself. I think that... what I'm going to do, if there's no objection, is Senator Metzen isn't here today, but we'd like to get his bill taken care of. It's a relatively simple bill, and I'm going to present it from right here, if it's okay. Senator Metzen's bill is Senate File. By the way, I'm a co-author. To legitimize this, okay. Well, I think I better go down there if there's a.
This is going to be.
I'm watching.
I'm in charge.
Senator Chamberlain, will you take the gavel? Got her. All right, very good.
Senator Saxog, your bill.
Mr. Chair, we're presenting Senate File 1106 for Senator Metzen. This bill will make changes in the Board of Cosmetology. With me today is Gina Strauss, Executive Director of the Board of Cosmetology Examiners, to give some brief testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Gina Strauss, and the Director for the Board of Cosmetology.
Thank you, Ms. Stout.
Thank you. The bill for the Board of Cosmetologists Examiners has two purposes. First, the bill addresses housekeeping changes in statutory language that is either outdated, inconsistent, or silent. Secondly, the bill continues the board's application fee that is set to sunset on June 30th, 2013. It creates inspection penalties and appropriates money to the Board of Cosmetology. With this bill, the board's contribution to the general fund will increase by $700,000 and appropriating $300,000 of that to the board. I would be happy to go through the bill, or I can just answer questions.
Members, do you have any questions? We have previously heard testimony from you, correct? Members, do you have any questions?
If not, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to lay Senate File 1106 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Senate File, according to request, Senate File 1106 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members.
Vote no. Should have taken control.
Chamberlain?
Anytime.
Mr. Chairman, any particular bill you want me to take first? We can take the firefighter bill.
Okay. Let's go down the line. Let's take Senate File 1006 first, Senator Pappas.
Okay.
Lawful gambling provisions modifications.
Then I would like to, if we could take the firefighter and police bill next.
That'd be fine.
That'd be great, because I'm sure, you came back. All right, can we take that one first?
Sure.
These guys have to get back.
So which one are we talking about?
457.
Okay.
They have to get back to the fire station.
That makes sense. Okay. Senate File 457, Senator Pappas, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We have an issue in the kind of public service area, police and fire, and some of our major cities in particular, where we have a veterans preference and we really want to hire veterans and people who are part of the National Guard in particular or the reserve, because we think they have the kind of the expertise that's very useful, and we want to honor their service. But when they're called up, there's kind of a hole that's left behind, and the firefighters and the police that are left behind, they often have to work overtime to fill in, and then that creates a financial burden for the local community. So what this would do is it would just provide a grant program from the state that could help with some of those financial costs that they incur while their members of their departments are away on public service. So this is Chris Parsons from the Firefighters Local 21 in St. Paul, and he's going to just give you some stories about, what they've had to deal with.
Welcome, Mr. Parsons, and if you just identify yourself and then go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Parsons. I'm a 12-year member of the St. Paul Fire Department, and I'm currently the secretary of the St. Paul Firefighters Local 21. We represent over 400 firefighter EMTs and firefighter paramedics in the city of St. Paul. I'm here today to support Senate File 457, as Senator Pappas stated, and I'll try not to to reiterate too much, but I would like to underscore that this bill supports our military efforts, supports public safety on the local level, and helps relieve the local taxpayer. It also fixes an unfunded state mandate. State law gives members of the military preference in hiring, and also allows for up to 15 days off each year paid for authorized military leave. And both those laws are decades old laws, and the cost of this law is being borne solely by local governments. There's no doubt that military members make great firefighters and police officers, and we want to encourage the Veterans Preference Act. But we just cities are in need of help from the state to fund the mandate. Last year in St. Paul, they spent about $400,000, and in 2011, the cost was about $500,000 backfilling for firefighters on military leave. A lot of this cost is outside the scope of this law. This law just covers a portion of that cost that's passed on the cities. The total city cost includes costs for long-term deployments, and as our military missions around the world kind of ramp down, those costs are going down, but there still are the ongoing costs for training 2 weeks a year and on the weekends. So I would encourage the committee to support this bill, and I'm here for any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Parsons? Yeah, Senator Chamberlain.
This is for either for Mr. Parsons or Senator Pappas. I was active duty Navy for several years, 4 years. Then I joined the National Guard, so I understand what you're talking about. And I had to take those days off and those leave days and balance it. And I understand we're only talking 15 days here, but what's the standard for private sector, though? I mean, those the people in the private sector, I'm concerned about the precedent here. How do we deal with the private sector? They're required to bear those costs as well. In the private sector, I know that we're going to talk about the difference between public safety and others, but still, there's a lot of gaps, a lot of holes that are left when people are called up or go serve the 2 weeks or called up for active service. So, how do we deal with that, and what's the danger of the president here?
Mr. Parsons can address that.
Mr. Parsons,
thank you. Mr. Chairman and Senator Chamberlain, the both laws. I believe only cover local government units, only mandate that local government units provide those preferences in hiring. And in the city of St. Paul, for instance, our civil service tests are based on a 100-point scale. A veteran, a disabled vet, can get 15 points, and if they're a resident of the city, another 5 points, which would give quite a boost give them quite a boost in the hiring pool. These are jobs that are very, very sought after. So as a result, we have a disproportionate number of veterans that are police officers and firefighters. So local government units are the target of the Veterans Preference Act, and also the state law, which requires 15 days off for authorized military leave.
And paid.
Paid.
No, I'm fine.
This question was about the private sector, though, too.
Well, other questions? Excuse me. Go ahead, Mr.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just to answer Senator Chamberlain's
Senator
question.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to our knowledge, we don't have that kind of mandate like that on the private sector.
Senator Chamberlain.
National Guard members that would take time off, I guess, would do it with vacation time or unpaid.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas. Well, I served in the private. I was in the private sector when I was in the Guard, and I know they didn't get paid for the time I was out for a month or 2 weeks or on the weekends or whenever I was supposed to be there. So I know they didn't get dollars for that. But thank you for your time. Thank you for your answer. Thank you.
Okay, I think it's worth noting that we do have a fiscal note, and it's for the biennium, it's about $2.3 million.
And, Mr. Chairman, if the committee would, see in its heart to fund this, it would be at whatever level you would set. because then it would just be prorated. This was the fiscal notes was an estimate on what the actual costs are for the 15 days.
So, yeah, we understand that, Senator Papasan, and if it's okay with you, then we'll take Senate File 457 and lay it over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members.
Next.
Want to do the gambling bill next, 1006?
That'll be 1006, okay. Let's take Senate File 1006. It was Senator Pappas.
No, we did not. Mr. Chairman, this is coming from the lawful gambling groups, and it's basically a technical amendment that just fixes some issues that are needed. And for example, it raises the threshold for organizations from more than $500,000 to $750,000 before they have to have a financial audit. And it adds some clarifying language related to paddle tickets and paddle ticket cards. And an applicant for a linked bingo game provider license must attach evidence of a bond not less than $100,000 as opposed to the current $100,000. And it expands the allowance for off-site gambling permits for an organization from 4 to 12 events per calendar year. And an organization is required to check the ID of a pull tab winner if the prize is $100 or over instead of the current $50. And it passed the state and local government committee with no opposition. It's here because of the dollars in the bill, but it's really a very minor change from the threshold of $500,000 to $750,000. And the fiscal note actually shows no impact.
Good.
Oh, the paddle. I'm sorry. I apologize. The paddle ticket card was all removed in committee.
Okay. So at this particular point, we're making these changes, which you made the committee aware of, but there's no fiscal.
No fiscal impact.
No fiscal impact. All right. Any comment, questions from the committee? Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas and members, I have an amendment that I'd like to present.
We're going to do members have that, or are we going to pass that out? We're going to pass that out. Does everybody have it? Senator Stumpf, as soon as everybody gets it here, you want to go ahead and explain your amendment, the A1 amendment?
Mr. Chairman and members, what this relates to is the linked bingo game, and what it does is it does a couple of things. It has a definition relating to first of all, before the definition, it also relates to what we call replica cards. And then the definition for what a replica card is. And I'm certainly not an expert on it, but what Linked Bingo does is allows players to play in more than one location. So you'll have bingo going on in different locations, and people who want to play can play in those multiple locations. But a replica card is actually the ability to play purchase this card and play away from an establishment. And so what you end up with is kind of a game that people could play, let's say, at home, or they could play at a senior residence or you know, not don't have to be physically at a bingo parlor. And I think that this is something that we should consider. And I don't know if someone wants to add further explanation to that or not, but it is something that I think will, you know, would be create a little more opportunity for the Link Bingo.
Senator Champion, do you have a question for Senator Stumpf?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Stumpf, can you kindly tell me if we look at subdivision 25A, specifically lines, well, the new language, who pays for this game, and also who will regulate it and be assured that the person on the other end of the game is someone who's of age to gamble?
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, maybe what I could do is see if we could get Mr. Someone from the charitable gambling to come up. But, oh, Tom? Barrett.
Yep. Okay. Barrett? Yeah, that'd be great.
Barrett? All right.
Sir, you identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Tom Barrett, Director of the Gambling Control Board.
Go ahead.
In regards to, I think if I understood the question, who would regulate it? The assumption would, this would be under the Gambling Control Board. It's a form of the charitable gaming, Link Bingo. The provisions here, though, involves the allowance for the player to play at home. To go to a site that offers charitable gaming, buy the bingo face, take the bingo face home, and then wait for the televised play of this particular Link Bingo game. But it would still be under our control, our authority.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes, Senator Champion.
And to the testifier, do you have some concern about the ability to make sure that once the game goes home, that the person who's actually operating it is someone of age?
Mr. Barrett.
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, so that's obviously a concern. At the point of sale, where somebody buys, be it a pull tab or anything else, there's always that issue of who's playing. But, yeah, once it leaves the premises, that would be a concern as far as somebody were to buy 10 bingo faces or all those being played at home. It'd still be registered in the system, eligible for a win, but that would be a concern.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, can you give me any background as pertains to looking at the amendment, the new language on lines 1.20 and 1.21 and 1.22, where this allows for a person to use a debit or credit card? Isn't there some concern when we think in terms of gaming, someone's ability to use a credit card or a debit card, because that seems to sink a person deeper into the areas of despair that we definitely want to stay away from? And it's a compound question, or whether there's some challenge around using a credit card versus using or debit card as opposed to using cash.
Mr. Barrett.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, what's allowed currently in law is the only instance where a debit card or a check could be issued is a raffle. And that normally is associated with a church raffle. Somebody's going to after mass writing out a check. That's the only indication or instance where anything other than cash is used. If this provision were to be considered, it would certainly open up the avenue in regards to the use of a debit card or credit card. Could we regulate it? Yes, but I think there's some issues that you addressed there that obviously fall back on the policymakers in terms of should that be an avenue for the purchase of charitable gaming.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Tomasoni did talk to me about this amendment, and I looked at it, but the first thing I told him is I really thought that because this is an expansion of gambling and because this is kind of new territory, the being able to use a debit or credit card, we don't currently allow that, that I thought it should be reviewed by my policy committee. So it does need more discussion and more work, and so I'm not supporting the amendment at this time. And I would like Mr. Lund to comment on it as well.
Mr. Lund.
Mr. Chairman, Alan Lund, Executive Director of Allied Charities of Minnesota, members as well. A while ago, I tried to convince the members of our charities to accept debit cards, as the lottery does. And our members, virtually to a member, said no. That is not where we want to go. There's ATMs in our facilities today. Every bar's got an ATM. There's a way for people to get cash. We are not in favor of going down that road. So we would have difficulty supporting that portion. We are not against looking at new ways to generate revenue, and this is something that we would certainly like to study, but at this time, we'd have trouble supporting it as written.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm inclined to agree with Senator Pappas, for the record, that the two problems with this, it is a huge expansion of gaming, and secondly, to open it up to the credit cards and the debit cards when nothing else really is, I think that's an extreme hazard. And I think, as Senator Pappas stated, that would have to be reviewed in depth and have a larger, longer discussion. But this is an expansion, and then an expansion on steroids with the credit cards. So I would agree. I would oppose this amendment.
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, I hate to see your proposal, you know, have to go back to the policy committee. If we drop Section 8 and we allowed, let's say, a study to occur over the interim, would you still have to go back to your back to the policy committee?
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, as Mr. Lund stated, that, you know, charities are interested in ways in which they can increase revenues. I do think that it is certainly something that my committee could look at next year. We didn't really look at any gambling bills this year at all, other than this purely technical bill, almost purely technical bill. It's a very minimalist bill. I don't know that we need to have language to do that. I can just tell you we can do it.
Senator Stumpfing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there's anybody else that wants to testify on this.
We will ask, yes. Yeah. Okay. Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to request a roll call.
All right. Roll call has been requested. Is there anybody else who'd like to testify on this particular amendment? Senator Tomasoni?
I don't know if I should be here.
He's here.
I happened to walk in.
You heard your name, right?
No, I just happened to walk in and you were doing it. So I thought I'd stick around. Mr. Chairman, I understand the concern about Section 8, and I think that removing that would be a good idea before you do the roll call. But I think the whole idea behind the subdivision 25A is to allow the possibility of people to purchase these replica cards and take them home and actually watch a television show that will be playing bingo. And it's bingo is what it is. Linked bingo is already available. People can already do linked bingo in the state of Minnesota. And linked bingo is nothing more than several different places that have authorized machines playing the same game at the same time. And actually, they could be playing with other states as far as it goes. So this is just adding a venue to the linked bingo. And I don't think that Subdivision 25 is harmful at all or a big expansion of gambling. It's just a different availability for people, and they can do it in the comfort of their homes. And I can understand the issue with the credit card, and I would concur with what Senator Stump said to maybe eliminate that from the bill right now and keep the rest of it in as a placeholder.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, whenever we do anything around gambling, there's always a lot of angst. And I think that this is a pretty new idea. And as I mentioned earlier, before Senator Tomasoni, I think, walked in, I think if it was introduced as a bill and we could, you know, a lot of people could take a look at it, we could have a thoughtful discussion about it in my committee, that would be kind of the preferred approach.
Senator Stump, what's your pleasure?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would just move to delete Section 8, and I actually I actually don't have a read on whether, I mean, I would like to see, certainly like to see a study, you know, of some move forward. And because I think, and Senator Pappas, you mentioned that you'd probably end up doing it, looking at it anyway. You know, maybe we, you know, as chair of the committee, you could maybe just go ahead and do that over the interim and give us some feedback next year.
Senator Pappas.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, we can certainly have the staff look at it over the interim.
Senator Thomasoni?
Certainly there's Senator Pappas' concern is that exactly what this language means is an issue. It is nothing more than somebody being able to watch how their card gets played that they have purchased. And so I don't think this is onerous because the linked bingo game is already available to people. However, I guess I can understand people being a little bit nervous about it. At the same time, if this were just to go on her bill right now, I'm sure you'd be able to get some feedback from some people in the meantime before it got to the Senate floor or got to the next step and actually find out exactly what this is that we're dealing with as opposed to voting it down because we're afraid of something that we don't know what it is.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'd move to delete Section 8.
Motion has been made to delete Section 8. We have an amendment to the motion on the amendment, the A1 amendment, that we delete Section 8. Any discussion on that? Not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Section 8 is deleted. Senator Stumpf, we have the A1 amendment as amended.
Mr. Chairman, I'll leave it up to Senator Stumpf, but I guess, Senator Pappas, what are you going to do with it if it goes on the bill?
Senator Thomasoni has asked to test it. Senator Pappas, do you want to respond or not?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Thomasoni, I guess it would go to full finance from here.
Yes,
and then I would ask the full finance committee to consider whether they want to continue with this. And if they continue to include this, then I probably would ask them to refer it back to my committee. And it's possible we could hear it still as a late bill.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I would ask Senator Stumpf, it's been alluded to here that this is even the first part, now that the steroid part's been removed, the first part is still a big expansion of gaming, in my humble opinion. We cannot argue that it is not when you're allowing anyone to buy these things and take them into their homes. That goes beyond the original intent of what we wanted to do here, and why we'd want to do this, I'm not quite sure. But it would need more consideration, and I think it needs that. So I'd just ask Senator Stumpf if he'd be willing to remove this and take it back through the proper committees for a more in-depth discussion of this issue.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Stumpf.
Senator Chamberlain, I'll withdraw the A1 amendment.
A1 amendment has been withdrawn. Further discussion on Senate file 1006. If not, we need to refer 1006 to full finance. Is there any discussion on that? Is there a rest?
I'll make the motion.
Make the motion. Senator Rest moves that 1006 be passed and re-referred to the full finance committee. Any additional discussion on that? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Bill passes. It will be going to the full finance committee. Senator Pappas.
beer.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1534 is the next bill, and I'd ask Mr. Hubinger to join me. Here he is.
Mr. Hubinger, Mr. Schroeder.
And Mr. Schroeder?
Yeah.
Just a little briefly, Mr. Chairman, and I'll turn
yes,
it.
Senator Papps.
I'll turn it over to the witnesses that are up here with me. This bill would implement the recommendations of the Compensation Council. The Compensation Council is a 16-member group, 8 citizens appointed by the governor, 1 from each congressional district, 2 citizens appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, 6 legislators, 2 from the majority caucus in each body and 1 from the minority caucus from each body. The council was charged to make recommendations to the legislature regarding salary increases that affected the members of the judiciary, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and the District Court, the constitutional officers, legislators, the governor, and salary ranges of the heads of state agencies. The council met 4 times and heard background information by staff. They heard testimony by interested parties, and they had discussions and adopted recommendations. And these are the recommendations that are in 1534. Basically, and I don't know if the committee has, assume the committee has some handouts, the report from the Compensation Council and some of the charts. But in summary, it would increase the salaries of the judiciary by 4%. In the July of 2013, 14, 15, and 16, it would increase the salaries of the constitutional officers by 3% on January 1st, 2015, and 2016. It would set salaries of legislators at 33% of the salary of the governor and would increase the salary range for heads of the larger state agencies to 133% of the salary of the governor and index that amount for inflation, and increase the salary range for heads of the smaller state agencies to 120% of the salary of the governor and index that amount for inflation. It would eliminate the salary of an agency head as a salary limit for employees of that agency. Instead, the limit would be the maximum of the salary range in the approved labor contract or compensation plan, and it would require the Commissioner of Management and Budget to contract for a market analysis of compensation for unrepresented employees. So that's kind of the summary, and maybe Mr. Schroeder might want to comment on behalf of the Compensation Council.
Mr. Chairman.
Schroeder, welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Bob Schroeder. I'm an appointee of Chief Justice along with Tom Frazier, and I'm here pinch hitting for Mr. Frazier, who is the chair of the council. He's out of town today and asked me to step in on his behalf. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and members for allowing me to be with you today. Every day, Mr. Chair, this this body here in the Senate and the House gets a chance to see folks from the executive branch, the judicial branch, and here in the legislature. And these are dedicated individuals, public servants who serve the people of Minnesota, and they do it very well, and we're very lucky to have them. The council recognizes that, I think, as all of the folks in this room do and in the Capitol. And we're very lucky to have that, and it's in public interest to keep it that way. Unfortunately, we've are at risk of slipping away unless we take some time to do something about it. We have circumstances now that the council has recognized that puts us at risk of attracting puts us at risk of wedding, attracting and retaining the very best, which is really in the state's best interest to do so. We have judges who have individuals who appear before them who are earning far beyond what the judges earn. These are public officials that are appearing before them. We also have agency heads, many of whom are running very large enterprises that in the private sector would be compensated with many more zeros behind their salaries than what they currently have. And same here in the legislature. We have dedicated individuals, public servants, elected officials, and staff who work very hard, and the council recognizes that. And we think it's important to have the tools available across all branches to attract and retain the very best that there is. And that really that's what the council's primary objective was we took on the task to review the compensation at all levels of state government, and our recommendations are laid out for you in the legislature in the report that I think Mr. Hubinger is prepared to go through.
Any questions for Mr. Schroeder?
Mr. Chair, do we have the report in our packet?
It's got the state seal on it. Is it there?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Pappas.
If there are no questions for Mr. Schroeder, then I wanted to bring up a panel of commissioners. Commissioner Showalter, Scott Peterson, Government Affairs for the Department of Transportation, and Mary Tinkerthal with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And I don't know if...
Did you want Mr. Hubinger to...
He was here if there were any, to explain the bill. I kind of explained it.
And he'll continue to be here.
Questions. Okay. He's here for questions.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, before we move too much further, what is your intent with the bill here?
The intent is to lay it over, and it will be discussed in small groups, and then it will be, if in the omnibus bill, we will have a chance to discuss it, amend it, change it, and then the omnibus bill, this doesn't have anything to do necessarily with this, will be heard in finance Thursday. So it's kind of...
Next Thursday. Yeah.
It'll be next week. Senator Gazalka.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this might be to the prior testifiers, but I just was curious why, I look at the governor position as the top position in Minnesota, and I'm just curious why they didn't look at moving that up and keeping the other percentages below that. Rather than bumping all the other positions quite a bit above that. If they have a comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
I think maybe we'll bring Mr. Schroeder back to address that. I do have an amendment, an A3 amendment, that does make a partial fix to that, which would index the governor's salary. It doesn't bring him up to the level he would have been had his salary been indexed over the last 12 years, but it's a little bit of a bump.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Schroeder, to Senator Gazalka's question.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Gazalka. I think the issue is effectively compression. It's a factor that has been in and around state government for a considerable period of time when it relates to the executive branch agencies and trying to attract and retain the very best. We have circumstances where we have salaries capped at commissioner levels, where the individuals that serve those commissioners are in many cases very qualified and in the private market could attract higher salaries. So we wanted to recognize that there's additional tools that those commissioners might need to attract and retain the very best. And I think Commissioner Showalter can probably speak more eloquently on the topic than I can.
And I'll let the other panel members.
Commissioner Showalter.
Mr. Chair.
Would you respond to Senator Gazalka?
Absolutely. Thank you for the record. My name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm not sure about the eloquence, but I certainly, on terms of the governor's pay, Minnesota's approach and the policy of having the governor as the top paid official in the state is an unusual one. Most states, in fact, and that's some of the evidence and information that went before the Compensation Council, most states, in fact, have pay for managers and other people who work for the governor that above the gubernatorial salary, in part for a very simple reason. There's a different labor market for governors. There's a different reason and a different set of rewards and risks that go with becoming governor than there is for a professional manager, for somebody who has particular technical expertise doing the public's business. And for that reason, many states de-link the pay level for certain positions from the gubernatorial cap.
Okay. Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Showalter. Do we know where our governor's salary compares to other states? Is it where are we on that range?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, we do. And, in fact, I would probably want to bring Mr. Hubinger back up to the table. There was significant numbers of comparisons of the gubernatorial salaries, judicial salaries, a number of different comparisons across states and how we rank. Certainly Minnesota stood out, and the conclusion that I took from that one of those charts was that we had a relatively comparable pay level for this governor, except for the fact that we were in a classification in a group of states that made that the top of the range. For most states that took that policy choice of having the governor being the top paid official, those gubernatorial salaries were significantly higher than in other states. And that's a policy question that was before the Compensation Council.
So we could have done that.
Mr. Hubinger, do you want to follow up on that? To Senator Gazalka's question.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. We help staff the council.
According to a Council of State Governments survey, the governor's salary of $120,000 is 32nd compared to the other states. When the governor's salary was last increased in 1999, Minnesota was like, I think it was 19th.
Senator Gazalka.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm just throwing this out that it's the first time I really had a chance to look at it, but I would have much rather seen something like the governor at 150 and work with the rest of the percentages, you know, for the legislators or and leaving the other ones the way they were. I respect the fact that you guys have spent a lot of time on this. I just want to throw my two cents in there.
And Senator Gazalka, you have the study now, and you've got all weekend. Okay, so in terms of our panel here, if you want to identify yourselves, we'd look forward to some testimony.
I will try to keep it brief, Mr. Chair. But again, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. With me, Scott, you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Scott Peterson. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for MnDOT.
And I'm Mary Tingerthal, Commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency.
I'll give you just a couple of quick comments overall, and then I think we want to just add a couple of comments around our views on this bill. To the governor's initial discussion with me about how he looked at the challenge of the Compensation Council and what it really is trying to do, this is part of our stewardship of the state. And this is part of making sure that the state continues to attract qualified expertise and skilled people for all three branches. That this is a difficult topic that the process requires legislators to take votes on things that are difficult, and it's why changes haven't been made for a number of years. And that doesn't change our responsibility to make sure that the state is still competitive for key positions throughout all three branches going into the future. To the Senator Gazelka's question earlier, in the governor's opinion, changing the governor's salary actually isn't probably desirous or necessary. As he said, you know, it is a unique market. But that doesn't change that overarching fact, that what we're trying to do here is make sure that regardless of one person's salary, that the system of state governance works. And a couple of key points. One is just the common recognition that the current system's broken, that we're not competitive for pay in state positions, even with local officials, that the way we try to change things or make compensation recommendations also needs looking at, that it oftentimes matters more where you work rather than what you do or the skills or experiences you bring into that position, and that the cost ultimately of deferring these judgments is something that really is not wise public policy. That the pay issue is really a question of how do we run state government? What kind of experiences do we want making decisions across the board? I would note that from the governor's standpoint and from all of our standpoints, people will talk in favor and be able to understand sometimes managers or judges and the need to get qualified people in those positions and how those pay might impact them. It's difficult to talk about legislative pay, but it's necessary as well. And we would strongly recommend that legislative pay increases are part of this and continue to be part of this package, because the time and dedication necessary to make the decisions to be here for the legislative sessions is significant. There are certainly activities going on outside of legislative sessions, and it is the administration's opinion, and strong one, that that is a necessary part of the overarching health of looking at pay across all branches, and we applaud the Compensation Council for including that in its recommendations.
Questions? Senator Gazalka.
So did you compare legislative salaries with the rest of the states, you know, as far as for your proposals? I think it comes out to around 42,000 or something like that. Is that comparable? Is that, or was there a range that you were looking at?
Mr.
Mr. Chair, Senator, again, I would defer to some of the tables that I don't have literally at my fingertips. I think the key thing from our perspective has been the number of legislative days, the tilting towards per diems as part of the way for remunerating activities of legislators, as opposed to being, I think, more upfront about that there's significant time and effort necessary to take these roles, and ability to keep people in these roles or attract new people into these roles in the future is a necessary consideration.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Showalter, there is a slight difference here. I understand what we're trying to get at. But these commissioners, I mean, you're appointed by the governor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a political appointment. So that's a little bit different dynamic. How does that play into the whole situation?
Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Senator, excellent question, because one of the things that Minnesota has had a history of is making sure that its political appointments also come in with significant expertise and understanding of their subject areas. I myself have been in state government for 18, 19 years, have been a professional and worked my way into a political appointment, that's true, but actually through multiple administrations. That is an unusual phenomenon, and I think that's one of the things that Minnesota should be trying to make sure, that mid-level managers aren't looking at literally a $5 to $10 increase in order to take substantially more responsibilities. Yet that's the way our compensation structure is right now.
Other questions from the committee? Senator Chamberlain.
I do have one, but maybe I don't know if I should wait. I've been looking at these charts, and I would just like a little graphs of stuff here. Just want a little explanation of what I'm looking at. I can kind of guess what I'm looking at, but just would like a little more.
Senator Chamberlain, if that's all right, we will ask Mr. Hubinger to help us.
That's good.
Do that. All right. Very good. Panel, it's up to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm filling in for Commissioner Zelli. He wishes he could be here to share these comments with you, but unfortunately he's out of town today. But I think the primary message for the Department of Transportation is we are currently experiencing a phenomenon where we have considerable salary compression at the top of the organization, the senior management commissioner and actually the managers that report to senior management are all making a salary roughly equivalent, separated by a penny or so an hour. In fact, so there are 40 individuals now who fall within that range. And so that in many ways becomes an impediment to get people to move up to take on jobs that have a higher level of responsibility and may be more demanding because the compensation is the same as their current position. And the other phenomenon associated with that then is that it becomes harder to hire people for some of these positions and harder to retain the people that are currently in these positions because, for example, people, we do a lot of, complicated and technical work at the Department of Transportation, not just with engineering, but other professionals in our organization. And when they get a significant amount of experience and in their craft, they become very attractive candidates for other jobs, for other government entities in the metropolitan area and particularly, and those local government agencies that have similar types of work actually pay considerably more than we're able to offer the same individuals for the same type of work. And then it's hard for us to recruit people because we have a hard time, again, enticing people from other state agencies or other government agencies to come to MnDOT to take on some of these more senior level responsibilities, which is, again, some of our more demanding technical work. So that's about all I have to say today, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Mr. Peters? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson or other testifiers. So this legislation, as is adopted. The group one can go up to, I think it was 133%. Do you see, are you already thinking through a plan about how the salaries would be adjusted? I'm assuming you're not going to bump everybody up to 133%. Could you explain how that process might work?
Mr. Peterson?
Or whoever.
Mr. Chair, we want to take a shot at it because okay. You know, that really is a decision for the governor ultimately. The law does give that flexibility to go up to that level. I would not expect that. And in fact, the fiscal note makes assumptions based upon a guesstimate of perhaps about a 10% increase for the first couple of years and then decreasing going into the future, trying to take care of some of the compression that Mr. Peterson was describing.
Thank you.
Ms. Tingenthal.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mary Tingenthal, Commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And I'm here not to just talk about the Housing Finance Agency, but really to speak on behalf of a number of commissioners. Across the state, we certainly have departments where the professionals that we're called upon to hire are really required to have the skill levels that need to draw from the private sector in many cases. And speaking, for example, with the Department of Commerce, which regulates our banks, our mortgage banks, and our insurance companies, the position of Deputy Commissioner for Oversight of Banking has been vacant for 6 months now after several rounds of national search. And simply even looking at the government pool of other bank regulators, the FDIC, the Federal Reserve, simply cannot attract people at the level of skill that is required to take on such an important position. Similarly, at the agency that I head, we issue bonds from the agency, several hundreds of millions of dollars a year, manage a large portfolio of bonds issued over the last 40 years. We are we go before the rating agencies as a standalone agency and are rated by Moody's and Standard & Poor's, much as the state is. And so the expectation there, because it is a standalone agency, is that folks like our CFO have the level of skill and expertise to be able to manage a portfolio of that nature, much as the folks in Commissioner Showalter's shop are required to interact with the management of the state's dollars. So I would just say again that the movement to 133%, in many cases, we think would sort of just barely get us to the point where we might be able to attract those level of candidates. And we appreciate the Compensation Council's recommendations and think that this will at least give us a fighting chance. So we appreciate the committee considering the recommendations of the council. Thank you very much.
Questions for Ms. Tingenthal? Very good. Thank you. Thank you for that input. That was great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Mr. Hubinger? We had some questions, I think, particularly from Senator Chamberlain. You have a set of information there that you'd like some explanation of. Was that fair?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. As I was saying earlier, I kind of have an idea what we're looking at here, but if you could go over it briefly and fill in the gaps, it would be helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair and Senator Chamberlain, I think there are two charts in your packets. The first one, the landscape that's a legal size, shows salaries for constitutional officers and is basically a salary history for the last many years back to 1999 and includes the proposed increases by the Compensation Council. If we start at the top with the governor, his salary was last changed in 1998 when it was increased to $120,300. It hasn't changed since. Compensation Council is recommending that the governor receive an increase of 3% in January of 15 and another 3% in January of 16. There was a law change made in 2003 which set the salaries of the other constitutional officers as a percentage of the governor's salary. So as a result of this governor's salary going up, the other constitutional officers' salaries would increase at the same level, at the same amount, percentage-wise. Middle group is the salary history for the judges, for the Supreme Court, for the Court of Appeals, and for the District Court, also back to 1998. Their salaries have increased more regularly over time. Those recommendations by the Compensation Council for the judiciary have been generally modified but implemented at some level of increase over this time period. The Compensation Council is recommending that the salary of all the members of the judiciary be increased in July of 2013 and July of 14, 15, and 16 by 4% in each of those years. The last category is on the bottom for legislators. Your salaries were increased last in January of 1999 to $31,000. Under the Compensation Council recommendation, your salaries would increase to $40,891, which is 33% of the salary of the governor in January of 2015. And again, since the governor's salary would be going up in 2016, they would increase to $42,000.
Any follow-up questions, Senator Chamberlain?
Oh, that's good. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Pappas,
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chair, we had the second document.
Who addressed? There's a second one, Mr. Ewinger. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, the second chart that was included in your packet is a salary history for heads of state agencies. The large agencies are indicated by a Roman numeral 1 in the farthest left column. Smaller agencies are in group 2. The ranges for the current ranges for these positions are in the footnote at the bottom. Group 1 for the large agencies, the salary limit for those positions is 95% of the salary of the governor, or $114,000. Group 2 is 85% of the salary of the governor, $102,000. The Compensation Council makes recommendations regarding the salary ranges, not the actual salaries. The Council is recommending that the salary limit for Group 1, the larger agencies, be increased to 133% of the salary of the governor. That's approximately $160,000. The Council also recommends that the limit for smaller agencies be increased to 120% of the salary of the governor, which is $144,000, roughly. The chart above shows the actual changes in salaries for the last 12 years. Most agency heads have not had an increase since the year 2000. The increases that you see there are for heads of agencies who are appointed by someone other than the governor, like the state retirement system heads or the State Board of Investment.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pappas.
I did want to just mention who from the Senate was on the Compensation Council and worked very hard on this, and that was Senator Cohen, Senator Rest, and Senator Miller.
All right, thank you for that information. Senator
Pappas, Mr. Schroeder wanted to add a comment
Senator
as well.
Senator Pappas, you didn't have an amendment.
I do. I have two amendments.
Do you? Okay.
Yeah. But Mr. Schroeder had a few comments.
Mr. Schroeder, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just want to try and address a couple of earlier questions. It's hard to believe, but 10 years ago, I joined the Plenty administration on their transition team and served the governor for two terms in a variety of capacities. A portion of my efforts were devoted to hiring commissioners and also participating in the judicial selection process as well. And I think Senator Chamberlain and Senator Gazelka asked a question of issues of what is it that attracts people to come to service, and I don't have a clear answer. I sometimes wonder why I did it, to be honest about it. But when we sought people to serve, it was four basic categories: character, competency, chemistry, and capacity were the four C's that we used. That issue of competency was particularly challenging. We could find really competent people, but salary was always an issue. People come to serve in government for a lot of reasons, and compensation is usually not one of them, but it's also a burden for a lot of folks. And so I just want to be sure to say that this is not an easy issue, especially when it comes to the executive branch. You heard from the Commissioner of Housing Finance and the challenges that she faces in her agency, and that is not unique. And for the two terms of the Plenty administration, whether it was in the judicial branch or the executive branch, we faced them as well. Also want to say on behalf of the council, you know, we didn't have the kind of time that compensation broadly in the private sector would demand a significant amount more time. So that's why in Section 9 of the legislation we have a compensation study that we call for to try and address this issue on a broader, longer-term basis, because we really think that's the approach that serves the interests of the state on a longer term. Our recommendations of 133% and the other recommendations are really part of the short term from the executive branch standpoint, and it's the longer term we hope to address if the legislature adopts the compensation study recommendation.
Thank you for your thank you for that, Mr. Short. Any other questions? Senator Chamberlain.
I almost hesitate, Mr. Chair, but it occurred to me there's a I'm going to wade into the swamp here. But it occurs to me that there's a larger philosophical question here. My perspective on these things is I think, you know, pay increases are fine. That's what the private sector does all the time. But quite often in this legislature these days, we hear about fair, how much is enough. So just as a philosophical point is that an average person out there making $40,000 or $30,000 a year would say, well, if you're making 120 or 68 or 70, that's enough. So we quite often hear that debate here and that accusation that, well, someone out in the private sector, they're making 120 or 150, let's go get them. Let's go do something and take some money and put it in the state coffers. And here we're talking about, well, 120, 150, 168, because we have to attract talent. I don't disagree with that. I'm a free economy type of guy. But I think there's a kind of a dissonance here, if I may, a disconnect in how we look at things. There's an average person out there making 30, say 120 is enough. And in the private sector, you make 120, 150, tax man's coming after you because you're rich. So that's just out there for thought. I don't know if it's going to, if I've thrown any dynamite out there, but I thought I'd throw that out there for your consideration.
Mr. Chair, sure. Senator Chamberlain, thank you. Senator, that's sounds like you might have said in some of our hearings, because that's exactly the type of questions that we had. This whole issue is a difficult one, and to the average citizen, I'd also ask the question, not just about salary, but also do you believe we want to have the very best serving the taxpayers' interest so that we're prudently managing their resources? And I think they would probably say yes to that as well. Most things in life are not black or white. They're mostly gray.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in terms of the process, those of us who served on the Compensation Council as legislators did feel a great deal of discomfort voting on the portions of the proposal that dealt with legislative salaries. And all except one of us abstained from the motion regarding legislator salaries. And to that point, legislators are in a very unique position on as the Compensation Council is set up, because the Supreme Court, for example, has it appoints members from the public. We did not have Supreme Court justices sitting on the Compensation Council. The executive branch appointed members of the public. The governor or the lieutenant governor was not on the Compensation Council. Neither were any of his agency heads. But the legislature, we did not appoint members of the public to make recommendations. We serve ourselves. And I think that's wrong. I think that in the future, with regard to a compensation council, we should change the law to indicate that the legislature, the leadership, whatever, could be the same number of people, but they should appoint members of the public to come back with a recommendation rather than putting legislators in a position that none of the other appointees are in on the Compensation Council. And I think it it's something that in the future we should reconsider, and that legislators should not serve on it.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, I have a LCC housekeeping bill, and we could make that change in the housekeeping bill, and
well,
I'd be happy to
you know,
that.
I'd be interested in I don't I, the history of how it developed that way. Why is it that the other two branches have representatives rather than principals, but the legislature has principals rather than representatives? I mean, how did that come about? And Senator Pappas, I really do think it should be changed for the future. And then there would be then a little bit of distance from it that instead of legislators feeling like on the council, and I certainly did, abstaining. I didn't vote on that part of it. You know, maybe if it was members of the public, they would have voted no or yes. But instead of that, the legislators that served, except for one who did vote no, did not participate in the vote on legislative salaries. And, of course, we can't act on salaries that affect us directly without an intervening election, as we know. But I don't think we should be on it at all.
And, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pappas.
Senator Rest, that makes a lot of sense. I think the purpose of the Compensation Council is to create that distance, and so you're really defeating that purpose by having legislators serve on it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, I certainly hope you would consider that. And it's not that we wouldn't choose representatives. I mean, that you know, the leadership could choose the same number of people. But it shouldn't be legislators themselves. Thank you.
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe a couple of or a question and maybe a comment. In your examination of the salary schedules and also just the discussions that you had about hiring and getting talent, is there a direct correlation between the amount that you can offer for a salary and the talent that you get? And I don't – this would probably be kind of to the commissioners, but since you were on that council, what kind of feedback did you get about that relationship?
Yep. Mr. Chair, sure. Senator Stubb, I don't have an absolute answer. It's a great question and not an unusual one. I can't tell you that it's an absolute deal breaker or not, but the fact of the matter is its salary is clearly a consideration. And by the way, we should also acknowledge that the salary is just a portion of compensation, financial compensation, you know, the health care plans and other factors that come into the broad picture of compensation, not just salary alone. So we consider all of those things. And there's certainly many benefits to being in public service. You know, the intangible one, of course, is serving the public interest. And I think everyone in this room gets that and has raised their hand and chosen to do it. But it is clear from my own anecdotal direct experience, having interviewed hundreds of people over the years for a variety of choices, you always get down to salary. And how much am I going to be taking home? And they have to make a calculation. How does it fit? I know I can think of a particular conversation I had with a current member of the court system who made a point to visit with me privately on the Compensation Council issue and to say each year they see their salary from a marketplace standpoint erode because of where they are on the bench. And it's always a dinner table conversation once a year with this individual's spouse. So I'm sorry I don't have a direct answer, but there is a correlation. I can't say it's perfect, but it's certainly something no one ignores.
Mr. Chairman, just a kind of a follow-up on that. You know, I think you're absolutely right. I think there is kind of a plateau that you have to get to when you're out. If you have talent as an individual and have something to offer, I think there is a plateau when they actually say, I'll consider this job. And then that's why if you don't reach that plateau, you may not even get applicants to respond to your job openings. But do you see in the modern, or not modern, but in the younger generations, more interest in other kinds of things than just the salary. And I'll give you an example. In some of our companies in northwestern Minnesota, they're seeking employees, and quite often I'll get feedback that, you know, it's obviously they got to have the salary at a certain plateau, but they'll say, okay, what are the amenities of the community? Are there lakes? Are there, you know, are there the quality of the school? How long do I have to, what is my schedule in terms of, will I have time for my family? Will I have time for the weekend or get the weekends off? It seems like there's a different approach to it than, let's say, my generation, which, you know, had a different perspective on work. And where does the state come in respect to that? I know we're just talking about salary, but is the state competitive in those other areas?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, I think the answer is yes sometimes and no sometimes, to be frank about it. I'm going to take just a couple of thoughts here. Far be it from me to be able to step into the mind of a 20 or 30-something and know what attracts them to it. But I will say, you know, I'm optimistic, broadly speaking, that that generation is interested in public service. I think we've all seen that from an election standpoint and otherwise. They like what happens, and they pay attention to it, and that's engaging, and that's a good sign. Whether that attracts them to come serve, I don't know the answer to that. Charlie Zelli, Commissioner of Transportation, is a neighbor of mine. We've known each other for 20-plus years, and he is a very young man, but he's taken the choice to take this job, I won't say as an encore, but it's not. I guess I will say, for the moment, it's an encore career opportunity for him. He came from the private sector after being successful for a long period of time to do his time in public service. Just had the same calculations that many of you have had. And I know we're grateful for that. But the fact of the matter is there aren't a lot of Charlie Zellies out there every day to fill all of these positions, like housing finance. There are a lot of things that attract people, and compensation is one of them. I used to say that, you know, it's not just what you do, but the conditions under which you do it that are part of the calculations. And that's the issue of those intangibles. What's the lifestyle like? I mentioned the four C's: character, competency, chemistry, capacity. Capacity is the key thing. At the risk of being politically incorrect, but if you're a single parent with four kids under the age of 10, it's going to be hard for you to be the commissioner of transportation and work 60 hours a week and be committed to your family like, you know, you want to be. That's a capacity issue, because these are hard jobs, and the executive branch and the legislative and judicial branch, these are hard jobs. They're 24/7. And so there are a lot of factors that go into it. And after a long day here at the Capitol, sometimes I'm sure you've asked yourself, why am I doing this?
Thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pappas.
A1 amendment, which I would appreciate if someone would offer. And this is has to deal with this compensation study we were talking about, and Mr. Hubin can explain it.
Move the A1 amendment. Needs to be passed out. We're doing that right now.
This is an author's amendment, is that correct?
This is an author's amendment.
This is the first committee. This is the first committee?
Yes.
All right. On the A1 amendment here, we're going to let Senator Pabs explain it, but all in favor of the A1 amendment?
Aye.
Opposed? Go ahead, Senator Pabs.
Mr. Hubinger is going to explain it.
All right. Very good. Senator Hubinger.
Mr. Chair, members.
Mr. Hubinger. Yeah, Senator, yeah.
Mr. Chair, the provision on line 1.2 deletes a reference to an obsolete agency head. Lines 1.3 through 1.6 relate to the appropriation to Minnesota Management and Budget for conducting the compensation study. Lines 7 and 8 are corrections or updates to the effective dates section of the bill.
Is there any questions on this?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I have the A3 amendment.
All right. Senator Dietzick offers the A3 amendment, author's amendment, and we're going to pass that out
to
you explain it before we
Hey, I think it's been replaced by the A4. Sorry.
All right. We have the A4. Senator Dietzick offers not only the A3, but the A4.
Mr. Chairman, I did notice something that I thought was missing from the...
Excuse me, Senator. We're working hard here, but we don't have them all out yet.
Oh, this is the A3. You passed out the A3 again.
Yeah, we don't want that.
We don't want the A3. We just want the A4.
So if you have the A3, just turn it over. Everybody have the A4?
I don't.
No.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, what the A4 would do is basically index the governor's salary. His, I believe, was the only salary that was not indexed, and it would just be indexed to the consumer price index. And I'm not sure what else it does. What is this about delete website?
These are all conforming changes.
And then these are conforming changes to this proposal.
All right. Great. Discussion on the A4 amendment. If not, we'll take a vote on the A4 amendment. All those in favor of the A4 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? A4 is in place. So we now have Senate File 1534 as amended. Senator Pappas,
are you just laying it over?
Anything else that
I have nothing else, right. Mr. Chairman. Unless there are questions or anyone else right. in the audience that wants
we,
to testify,
we ask the committee for questions. Any other testimony from the public? All right. That being done, Senate File 1534 is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, all of you, for a good discussion. All right. Senator Dietzick, could you take over for me, please?
You missed the opportunity to have history lessons to see if this was something. I think next September.
Joel?
We're handing out some handouts right now, so if you can hold on a minute. Okay, Senator Saxhog, would you like to start? We have before us Senate File 1524.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. 1534. Will appropriate money for the Association of Minnesota Public Education Radio Stations, also known as AMPRS. And with me today is Joel Glazer, Executive Director of AMPRS. He's going to give some brief testimony for the need for additional funding. And for the committee's information, when you've got the bill, what will be included, probably included in the omnibus bill, we will be removing sections 1, 2, and 5, which are policy sections, and the only thing that will be left is the funding. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Glazer for.
Thank you, Mr. Glazer. Welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Joel Glazer. I'm the Executive Director of AMPRS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. As most of you are probably aware, we were before the committee here fairly recently. We had the opportunity to address and mention to you that we have three new community radio stations, all of which are now in northern Minnesota, new to Minnesota. Our requests, which you have before you, reflect a need for a slight increase to stay flat on the equipment grants. On a per station basis, it would actually be flat. And for our community service grants, same situation, but we are asking for a slight increase there because we would like to start moving towards emergency messages in foreign languages. So with that, since we have been before the committee, Madam Chair, if there are any questions, if not, we appreciate your support.
Are there any questions? No questions.
Thank you, ma'am.
Senator Sacksock, do you have any closing remarks? Otherwise, we will leave
this over. The only thing I guess I could say is that maybe we should remove sections 1, 2, and 5.
Okay.
So I guess I would move that sections 1, 2, and 5 be removed from the bill.
Senator Sacksock has a motion to remove section 1, 2, and 5 from the bill. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed.
With that. I would hope that it be laid over for a possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Senator Dietzick, Senate File 910.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. Before you for your consideration is Senate File 910. This bill allows the Secretary of State to accept funds for two different parts of the office, elections and the Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program. It requires the funds to be deposited in a special revenue fund and requires an annual report to the legislature on the funds received by the office. I believe we have an amendment to pass out that tightens some language and defines local government units.
Okay, so we need to you're offering the A1 amendment.
Correct.
Okay. Cash. We're gonna pass that out. Or is it in the packet?
I think it's in the packet.
It's in the packet.
Yep.
And this is not the first hearing for the bill, so we'll have some discussion here.
Correct.
First. Yeah.
Yep.
Go ahead.
So with me is Claire Wilson from the Secretary of State's office, and I will ask her to go over the bill.
Ms. Wilson, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claire Wilson. I'm with the Office of the Secretary of State. This bill allows the Secretary of State to directly accept funds for two different parts of the office, both the elections and the Safe at Home program. And Section 1 relates to the elections part of the office. And this bill allows the office to solicit and accept funds from local election officials or local units of government for technological projects and improvements. This would be of help if there's a certain functionality that local jurisdictions feel is important to have added to the state systems that's not in the state's budget or that isn't a high priority for the state at the time because it would only apply to one or a few jurisdictions. It also allows the Secretary of State to accept federal funds without going through the Legislative Advisory Committee process, but only if the acceptance of those funds does not require the state to commit to a maintenance of effort. Going through this process is time-consuming and can be cumbersome and has resulted in some delays. So, for instance, we had a federal grant for improvements for our military and overseas voters that the office received in December of 2011. But by the time we had gone through the process and were allocated the funding in March of 2012, we were able to provide the enhanced services for the general election but not for the primary. And then the Secretary must also report annually on any funds received under this section. The second section of the bill relates to our Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program. And for those of you who are not familiar, the Safe at Home Address is our state's address confidentiality program for people who fear for their safety. 30 other states also administer an address confidentiality program as a tool for victims to ensure their safety. Since the program's inception in 2007, over 2,275 program participants have participated in the program, the majority of those being children at this time. Currently, there are over 1,200 participants. The program is governed by Chapter 5B and administered through the OSS, and this particular section does amend Section 5B. Program participants apply to enroll in the program through Victims Advocate statewide. It's not an easy or simple program in which to enroll. And for all practical purposes, once they enroll in the program, they live in a P.O. box. So this has a direct impact on participants' lives in a very significant way, and in many instances has saved lives. So because of the incredible impact that the program has had, some participants have wanted to contribute a small amount financially back to the program. So this bill then gives the Secretary of State the authority not to solicit, but to offer to accept contributions from individuals. We've had in the past to explain to those wanting to give that they can make a contribution to the state, but that the process involves filling out multiple forms. It's unclear whether the contribution would go directly into the state general fund or to the program. And in some cases, they've decided not to contribute at all. This also gives the Secretary of State the authority to apply for grants from charitable foundations and for federal grants. And similar to the elections provision, allows the office to not necessarily go through the Legislative Advisory Committee to accept the federal grant as long as there's not a maintenance of effort requirement. And finally, the Secretary of State must report annually on the funds raised under this section as well. The only exception in this instance is that if participants have given to the Safe at Home program, that would be an aggregate report and their names would not be included.
Questions, particularly on Section 1, where the A1 amendment is located.
So this came, this amendment came, thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment came about. Yes, thank you. This amendment came about as a discussion with council, and they thought better language and tighter language would be to that the Secretary of State's office would enter into an agreement, which is actually what they would do, the actual process. So they're not, you know, soliciting funds. They're entering into agreement would require them to do that, and then it actually defines local government units below 117 so that it clarifies that so there's no ambiguity of who they're working with. So that short and sweet amendment.
Question for Senator Dietzick or Ms. Wilson? If not, Senator... Yeah. Oh, that's right. We're going to move that A1 amendment. So Senator Dietzick, move the A1 amendment. Any discussion on that? If not, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? A1 amendment. So we right now, Senator Dietzick, have Senate File 910 as amended. Any discussion on that? All right. We'll lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
That being said, anything else to come before the committee? Tuesday of next week is our day that we will close out the omnibus State Departments and Veterans budget bill. So we'll review it, and we start on our normal time, and we'll work the bill until it's completed. So there's no time limits on it, and we'll just do what we have to do. It's my hope then that we do our normal committee time, and we have this room reserved, and it isn't. Is it this room or the other one? We have 107 till we're done. So, with that, have a good weekend, unless you're working tomorrow, and the meeting's adjourned.